to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Welcome to both of you.
We're both happy to be together on the Zoom studio. It's been quite a week. I'm just happy that I lost power for only one day, not the whole week, like some in Ames in central Iowa. And I live in an apartment, so I didn't have any tree damage. What about you, Gina?
Well, I had quite a week, too. I had quite a few trees down during the storm, and my power went out for too long, and then I took off yesterday after I got all that cleaned up and came out to Colorado for my parents' 63rd wedding anniversary. So Zoom is the only way I could be here. But when I found out Chad Hart was going to be one of your guests, I didn't want to miss the chance to talk with him.
Yes, that's why I wanted you to be here. When you asked if he could tell us how the derecho would affect the price of corn, I knew that you should be the one to talk with him. But first, we have our monthly Story County Report from Leanne Harder. Hi, Leanne. Welcome. Great to have you with us.
So, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Well, I have a lot to try to get in a very short amount of time. So I am going to start with follow-up to the August 10th derecho storm event. For anyone out there within Story County, whether inside city limits or in the unincorporated areas, if you did have damage to your house, only the home, not garage or outbuildings, Story County Emergency Management is asking you to go to a link on, and it's on our website, Story County's website, and on our social media, and I can get to you guys to share as well. You go to that link and you fill out a damage assessment form. This will help target some of the resources that are needed from county staff to go out and check on the damage, but also this is all information that gets gathered and forwarded onto FEMA. So I will send, the link is really cumbersome to say, just know it is on our website and hopefully you guys can share it for us. At this time, the Mid-Iowa Community Action, also known as MICA, has two programs available for anyone qualify for 200% or below the poverty line. That's the Iowa Individual Aid Program for individuals and families. Again, that's income at or below 200% of the poverty line. And then anyone can also talk to them for disaster case management. And that helps individuals and families put together a disaster recovery plan. Those programs, again, are administered by MICA, and their phone number, where you can call, is 515-956-3333. Story County Conservation Parks did receive a lot of damage, tree damage. Many of them remain closed to the public. They are working to continue to clear parks and trails. This will be going on for quite a while. They are posting updates on our website. You go to storycountyiowa.gov and find conservation. As of August 17th, all parks remain closed with some exceptions. I do want to note all accesses to the Skunk River are totally closed at this point, except for a few areas. And really, to the Skunk River, they're still impassable, so don't try to go down there. Please use caution when you are in those reopened parks. Stay aware of the surroundings and don't go under or near damaged trees. There may still be some loose limbs up higher in the tree canopy. Some trails in the parks are blocked off still. So if there's caution tape and barricades there, please mind those and don't go around them for your safety and those around you. Everyone does thank you for the patience and cooperation, and conservation continues to post updates as more areas are cleared. Now switching to some studies that are underway. Story County, its communities, and RDG Planning and Design, which is a consulting firm that Story County has hired, started the process in July to complete a housing needs assessment for all of Story County except for the city of Ames. Ames had already, as part of their comprehensive plan update, had been working on housing. We really want input at this phase. We are helping, we have a survey online The survey is available at surveymonkey.com/r/Story County Housing. There's also paper copies that I can send out, and I can send the link. There's also a Spanish version. This is really to understand what's happening in the owner-occupied and rental housing throughout Story County, and we're hoping to get as many residents throughout Story County that responding to the survey so they can share their personal experiences in the housing market. Planning and Development is excited to announce that they have now gone live with CitizenServe. Been talking about this for a couple months. It's their online zoning permitting system. That allows people just from anywhere 24/7 to apply, track, and pay for zoning permits. Right now, it's only for zoning permits. They will be adding the other development cases and related applications in the near future, but they are live with zoning permits. So if you're doing any type of construction in unincorporated Story County, go to the website or email them. They are pzweb@storycountyiowa.gov. or their phone number is 515-382-7245. They do also want to note that the United States Census is still hiring temporary census takers. Those temporary census takers interview residents at their own homes to obtain census data. You can apply at 2020census.gov. If you go there, you see a list of requirements. That in the interest of time, I think I'll just refer you to their website. But do know that the census says the health and safety of Census Bureau employees and the public are top priority during this unprecedented time. The Treasurer's Office would like to remind everyone that the Governor's Proclamation for Motor Vehicles issued did expire. So that means several things. One, all registration renewals for January 2020 through July 2020 must be submitted by August 31st to the Treasurer's Office, or they will be assessed a late penalty starting September 1st, 2020. So if you're one of those that you've been sitting on your registration renewal in the first 7 months of the calendar year, contact the Treasurer's Office. Also, all motor vehicle title transfers completed between March 17th and July 25th must be turned in to the Treasurer's Office by next week, August 24th. And then call the Treasurer's Office at 515-382-7330 to discuss questions or have them help you walk through motor vehicle transactions. Now flipping to property tax side for the Treasurer's Office, people should have received property tax statements in the mail this week. If you do not receive one, call the Treasurer's Office and they can get you another copy or get you some information. The administration building in Nevada still remains closed to public, and that is where the Treasurer's Office is located. You can pay your property taxes online through the mail. There's a drop box in the front of the county administration building. Just know if you do come to Nevada, there is a lot of construction in Nevada. 6th Street in front of our building remains closed, as well as J Avenue. So you may have to take some alternate routes to get to our building. If you want a receipt for payment, just include a self-addressed stamped envelope with a tax payment. Again, the Treasurer's Office number is 515-382-7330, or you can find them online at storycountyiowa.gov. On our website, there are call for openings for boards and commissions in Story County. The deadline is about a little month and a half away, September 30th, 2020. The Analysis of Social Services Evaluation Team, otherwise known as ASSET, has one opening, Board of Health, two openings, Conservation Board, one opening, and Commission Veterans Affairs, two openings. So again, if you're interested, the application is on our website under Boards and Commissions. And then an important message from Story County Environmental Health, and this is a notice going out to all Story County private well owners. The office recommends that private well owners at a minimum have water well tested annually for bacteria and nitrate levels. In addition, any time a well owner experiences a power outage that lasts long enough for your water system to lose all pressure, the water should be tested once the power was restored. Story County residents can contact Story County Environmental Health to set up an appointment for a free or no cost private well water testing for any of the following: coliform bacteria, nitrate, manganese, or arsenic. That's through the Grants to Counties program. So to set up an appointment or more information, you can email healthweb@storycountyiowa.gov, or their phone number is 515-382-7240. Last, before I tell you how to notify us, we are pleased to partner with several entities in the Cyclones Care Campaign throughout Ames and Story County. Keep sharing the message out there, the four pillars of healthy behavior, and see our information on all our websites. If you're on social media, don't miss out on Story County's happenings. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at Story County, Iowa. And as always, you can contact me directly at lharter@storycountyiowa.gov, or my phone number is 515-382-7247. I think I went a little bit over, Susan, but I had a lot to share today.
Yeah, that was really, really an important report. It's ironic because we had a recorded local talk last week, so you were postponed. Good thing. I mean, good timing.
Yep. I think next month I might even have a little bit longer report.
Okay.
So we'll plan accordingly. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks to the news. I think this was really important to get out there. So thanks for being with us, Leanne. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, and we just heard from Leanne Harter, Outreach and Special Projects Manager for Story County. Our next guest will be Dr. Chad Hart, Agricultural and Natural Resources Economics Extension. Welcome, Chad. And my co-host, Gina McAndrews, told me that you're also the Extension Grain Market Specialist, so I'll let her properly welcome you to Local Talk.
Welcome, Chad. I hope you're doing well today. You're the right person to tell us about the massive crop destruction last week and how that's going to affect our farmers.
It's going to be challenging for them as they look out there. We did have significant damage to corn and soybean fields and to the farms themselves, grain bins, barns, sheds, even the homes. The idea is that, some of the damage we've seen here, for example, across Ames and Story County, is basically replicated as you go all the way to the Illinois border.
Do you know the extent of the crop acres damaged?
At this point, we don't have a full assessment yet. We do know in the hardest hit areas, you're talking about 3.5 million acres of corn, 2.5 million acres of soybeans that were in the worst of the derecho. That cover about 36 counties here in Iowa. But then there's secondary effects even outside of those areas.
And so a lot of that corn I saw, I had to go to my aunt's funeral last week and went to Dubuque, and up by Highway 20 all the way east was all good. And then coming back on Highway 30 was a whole different story.
It is a whole different story. The best way I can describe it is it looks like if you've ever seen tornado damage, the idea is it looks like that. It's just over a much, much wider pathway than usual. Like it's like three counties wide worth of tornado damage.
And what's the chance of that corn that was blown over surviving or producing ears or?
Well, most of it would already have an ear on it. So the idea is we're about 50% through the grain fill period. So it has an ear. It's not mature yet. If the corn was snapped, if the stalk snapped, it's done. That will not mature anymore. If it's laid over, it depends on can it continue to pull up nutrients. That those ears of corn will fight to, if you will, stay alive and mature, but it will just take them a heck of a lot longer, and it will be a heck of a lot harder to harvest than usual. So we're going to see significant yield and production losses for our Iowa farmers, basically from Carroll all the way to the Illinois border.
Oh, it didn't affect west of Carroll?
Not really. The idea is you can think of the really strong winds, 60 mile an hour plus sustained, really started in that Carroll area. And like I say, rolled through Iowa to the Illinois border. And then we continue to see wind damage going through Illinois, Indiana, even into Ohio.
Is it keep that same width and breadth of damage?
Not the damage itself. It seems that once it crossed the Mississippi River, the damage lightened up. I mean, they still had wind events, but they were, if you will, shorter in duration. And so we see less crop damage once you move outside of Iowa.
And how about the beans? I mean, the beans seem short enough that people think that shouldn't affected them too bad, but sounds like that's a different story.
That is a little bit different story. I mean, the beans did fare better than the corn just because you're right. The idea is the physics is the plant is smaller, so it didn't catch as much wind. But, you know, the beans basically got pelted by everything that was being blown around end to end. And for lack of a better term, it was like hail hitting them. So the idea is you think about all the debris, the tree limbs, even the corn plants that were sent flying through the fields with this strong derecho. It did damage the beans because of that.
It sure didn't seem to affect the price too much. I mean, it's still gone down the last couple of days, not much, but.
Well, that's the deal. We had a little bit of a bump in prices late last week. Corn added 15 cents. Beans have been up like 40 to 50. But you've also, yeah, as you say, the last couple of days, prices have moderated down a bit. And it's because the damages, for lack of better terms, are localized. Here we've had the crop damage here in Iowa, but it doesn't really spread much beyond our borders. And the rest of the country are looking at some really good crops right now.
And how about the beans? What's the chance of them coming back with that leaf damage?
If it got significant leaf damage, it's probably a little too late. You know, for those that haven't lost significant leaf area, they should continue to recover and produce pods, you know, and fill out. So we are looking at, and this is why it's so hard to assess total crop damage right now. We don't know how much of the crop will be able to carry forward.
Now, is that something that would be covered in the insurance?
Yep, these types of losses will be covered under federal crop insurance. Federal crop insurance is known as multi-peril, meaning that it covers a variety of events. Basically, anything that's described as an act of God. So you can think of, you know, flooding, drought, even things like this derecho, tornado. Those types of physical damages happening to the crop are covered by crop insurance.
And then how do they receive payment for their insurance?
In this case, you know, it works through a private company. So it's you can think crop insurance is a public-private partnership. The government helps set it up, but actually it's private companies that sell and service the insurance. So farmers will be working with crop insurance agents. They'll have an adjuster come out, look at the damage to the crop. They fill out the paperwork. It sends it up the company chain, and then they will receive a check from that company for the damage later this fall.
How do they get compared to the price? How do they adjust what they get for that?
So it depends upon the type of insurance that the farmer has bought. They can purchase what is known as just yield insurance, which means we'll measure what the yields are on the farm compared to historical average, and we'll pay you a set amount per bushel. That set amount was determined in the springtime before they planted. For example, for corn in Iowa, that set price is $3.88 a bushel. On the other hand, they can buy revenue insurance as well, which takes into account not only their yield changes over the year, but price changes over the year. And as you mentioned, corn and soybean farmers here in Iowa have been watching prices fall throughout the year for the most part. So this revenue insurance covers not only that price loss, but it would also cover the loss of yield they're seeing here from the derecho and the drought.
And speaking of the prices, how come they haven't been going back up those last few months?
Well, it's been, let's call it a challenge of one. When we look nationwide, it looks like we're going to have another big crop, even with the problems we've had here in Iowa. The estimates right now would probably put the national corn crop as the second largest we've ever produced. The bean crop is probably in the top five of what we've ever produced nationwide. So you got a lot of supply. That holds prices down. On the demand side, though, we're still struggling with, let's call it the after effects of the shutdowns and the slowdowns due to COVID-19. So we're just not seeing crops being used as quickly because the economy is still in a depressed state right now.
How about internationally? Does China and some of those markets also have an impact?
It definitely does. In this case, when you look at our corn and soybean crops, we export about 15% of all the corn we produce. We export about half of all the soybeans we produce. China is a big market for us. The big three that we sell to would be Canada, Mexico, China. And what we've seen there is slower sales through the first half of the year here, but it looks like things are picking up as we've gotten here to July, August, and we would expect those sales to increase as we get closer to harvest.
Now, is our trade deal open again with China for soybeans?
It is open. The idea is that we signed that phase one deal in mid-January, and China has been buying product from us ever since. Probably not quite at the pace to fully meet that deal yet. But again, it's one of those things that they're sort of, if you will, it's ramping up. They started out slow, and as days go along, they keep buying more and more. They're picking up the pace.
And how about Canada and Mexico? Have they been using less because of the virus or anything?
A little less there, especially we've seen the impact in the trade with Mexico. That it seems the virus is having a fairly strong impact on their economy. But overall, I would say, you know, export sales, international sales are looking pretty good as we get into the fall. The struggle has been to get here to the fall.
Being a source of a lot of corn already, what does Mexico do with a lot of our corn? Does that go into fructose syrup type of products or?
No, what you see mostly with our corn there is a lot of livestock feed. So when you think about why other countries are buying our corn and soybeans, it would be first and foremost to feed their livestock.
How are the livestock numbers in Iowa? Have they been increasing the last few years?
We have been. In fact, when you look at the entire meat market, the idea is whether you're talking about the cattle industry, the hog industry, or even the birds or broilers or poultry. We're seeing really strong numbers out there. In fact, the U.S. is on pace that in 2021, we will produce a record amount of meat for the country.
Wow. And how's Iowa faring in that? Have we been increasing?
Yep, we have been. And especially, I mean, we're definitely the leader on the pork side, continue to be there. We've seen some rebuilding on the cattle side. As far as the poultry are concerned, we've been the leading egg producer for quite a number of years here in the state of Iowa. And so when you look, we definitely rely upon a great deal of animal agriculture to help drive some of our economy.
How's the ethanol production going to change in the next few years?
We definitely saw, as the COVID shutdowns hit, we saw that industry basically get cut in half. There's been about a 90% recovery thus far. So most ethanol plants are back up and running and producing fuel. And some of them are still producing hand sanitizer as well, given the need for that. But we have still a few plants that are shut down. Financial conditions have been rough for the industry. And when we look out over the next 2 to 3 years, it's likely that some of those older plants that were, say, built in the 1980s likely won't come back online. So we may see a slightly smaller industry as we move forward, at least over the next couple of years.
And what happens to the majority of our crops? What percent of it stays in Iowa for use as far as corn and soybeans?
We do use a fair amount of our own crop now anymore, especially, you used to think about, go back 20, 30 years, most of our corn left the state. Now it's the case of, we've got the ethanol industry built here. We've got the livestock industry, especially the pork industry that is a large consumer of corn here in the state. So we do use a lot more of our own corn than we used to. Now, soybeans is still a crop that, over half the country's soybeans, leave the country to go somewhere else. So it's one of these challenges of you want to create value when you can, but sometimes the best value you can create is just shipping your product off to somebody else.
You think there's going to be much to come back with people raising their crops and feeding it directly to their livestock like they did 50, 60 years ago?
Well, there's, you know, that's actually, when we look at agriculture, especially with young folks who are wanting to get back into agriculture, livestock is one of the, let's call it, better alternatives for them right now, because it's something you can do at a smaller scale. You don't have to have hundreds of acres like you might need on row crop to produce a living to raise a family. But livestock, you can do that, like I say, on a much smaller scale. And it has been profitable at times over the years. And especially like right now, I'm noticing like the cattle market, those prices have rebounded fairly well, and things are looking pretty good on the cattle side. Where we're struggling right now financially, mainly the pork industry.
And why do you think that is?
Again, just like the corn and soybeans, lots of supply right now. I mean, demand is good, but we just have a lot of pork that is available in the marketplace right now, and that's holding prices down.
Is that opened back up to China?
It is opened back up to China. China is our number one export market for pork. And actually, based on the data right now, we've almost doubled sales to them over the past 2 years.
Wow. So what do you think's going to happen next year? The prices going up, or any changes in the farm programs?
Well, we probably won't see any changes in the farm programs, but we'll likely see some adjustment in what people plant out there. This year, for example, we saw a lot more folks plant more corn over soybeans. If I had to guess right now, I think you're going to see a shift back towards soybeans, especially given where prices stand today. Soybeans have recovered a bit better. And when we're looking at that international demand, if China meets that phase one trade deal, that means they're buying a lot of soybeans. That should help drive that market a bit higher.
Is there a phase two set up, or how is that working?
Not yet. So the idea is that they named it phase one, thinking there would be a phase two in fairly short order. But we haven't seen any real negotiations to create that next deal with China.
And it seems like there's a lot of smaller packers kind of being pretty full, with a lot of people buying local meat with this virus and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Have you noticed a lot of that? Or?
Yeah, we have. I mean, you know, if you think back and when we were really seeing the bigger processing plants like Tyson and JBS have to shut down because of the coronavirus, you saw a lot of not only producers, but consumers shift to look at smaller locker plants and meat processing facilities to try to source meat. And that booked up our small processing plants out for a long time. I know in talking with several folks here in the central Iowa area that run processing, you know, small processing units, that some of them are booked out all the way into 2021 right now, because they had that much interest. And let's face it, you know, when you're running a small facility, you can't process that many animals in a day. So it doesn't take much to book you out. I grew up in a small locker plant. My parents ran one in Southwest Missouri. And so, you know, we could process 3 or 4 animals a day. So if you think about it, it wouldn't take much out of a large hog barn to fill us up for a year. And that's exactly what's happened for a lot of our small locker plants.
You think that's going to cause a little more push for the decentralization of the three packing with the, you know, increase a little more markets? And
well, you are seeing, and USDA does investigate this every few years. They do look at the concentration within animal agriculture. I think what you're going to see is sort of, let's call it a two-pronged thing happening here. Right now, we are seeing a lot of folks use those smaller locker plants, and hopefully that means we'll see a few more of those, you know, populate the landscape here as we're moving forward. But you're also seeing changes at the big 3 or 4 processors as well. I think coronavirus highlighted that maybe they need a few more facilities throughout the countryside. That way they can avoid some of the problems that they saw by having this concentrated plants, very large plants. They're great for being efficient, and producing a lot of meat, but they were also terribly efficient at spreading the virus.
Well, we sure appreciate having you today.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and Gina McAndrews is one of today's local talk hosts who just spoke with Chad Hart, Extension Grain Market Specialist, and I think you got quite a bit of information about the farm economy, not just about the derecho and its effects. I'm Susan Franzen, and I'm hosting the last half, which is recordings from a panel on August 12th, hosted by Iowans for a Safer Return to Learning. I'll let moderator Chris Draper introduce the panelists and tell you about it.
Thank you for joining us. My name is Chris Draper. You're a moderator today. As a risk management expert, father of four public school kids, and mediator for IEP Equity, where we help parents of students with special needs be heard as they return to really an unknown classroom environment, this topic today is of extreme importance to me, as well as many of us around the state. COVID-19 has forced the education community in Iowa to fundamentally rethink how we attend and now reopen school. Iowans for a Safer Return to Learning is a group of educators who are very concerned with Governor Reynolds' decision to allow schools reopen under potentially unsafe conditions. They'd like to see Governor Reynolds pay more attention to science and facts and how we can use that information to inform our return to learn plans. How can the public health and medical community come together to provide perspective and facts for the public and for school districts to inform their decisions? Today's call is an attempt to provide more perspective and more facts around a meaningful discussion. I'll go over today the participants in our call today. To start off, Laura Van Wartheisen. Ms. Van Heisen is a teacher educator and manages a family and consumer sciences education program at Iowa State. She also serves on a leadership team for Masks for Iowa, an organization of over 3,000 volunteers founded originally to sew and provide masks to Iowa frontline workers in March due to the shortage of PPE. Our second speaker is going to be Linda Tucker Reinders. Ms. Reinders is the executive director of Iowa Public Health Association. Her 20-plus year career in public health spans county and state health departments in Minnesota to 7 years with World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland, where she was part of the H1N1 pandemic response team. Since moving to Iowa in 2013, Linda has been awarded two leadership fellowships, was adjunct faculty at Simpson College, and more recently joined the nonprofit sector. Throughout her public health career, Linda is dedicated to using a systems approach to address quick equity. Dr. Megan Schreninas is an infectious disease physician at the University of North Carolina who resides in rural Iowa, Fort Dodge, so rural is not selling Fort Dodge. Her research focuses on using social innovation to address health inequities, especially looking at rural access to care. She's been very active in both COVID-19 research and advocacy for policy guidelines during the pandemic. And last but not least, Sarah Ann Willett is a data scientist and coder behind the Iowa COVID-19 tracker. She finds discrepancies in the COVID-19 data that the state of Iowa provides, assists Iowans in making risk assessments for themselves and their families, breaks down preprint and peer-reviewed publications for mass consumption, and makes projects for how the pandemic is trending both on the county level and statewide. So, getting to the facts and the important stuff. First off, when looking at the areas where Iowa's really stood out from other states, first up is masks. Ms. Van Wartheisen will open up on why Iowa's approach to masks should be reconsidered at best.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here today. My beginning was a health and FCS teacher. So if I can take you to high school health for a moment, I'd remind you that viruses are different than bacteria. We can't just kill viruses simply. We have to work on prevention. And because infection and contraction of the disease are different points, or when the disease manifests, there is an incubation period before we show symptoms where we might have been actively shedding and spreading the disease. Again, this happens before you feel symptoms because of the way the viruses work to spread themselves. And because that COVID can travel by respiratory droplets, I point out that masks were originally not designed to protect the wearer. Instead, they were designed for surgeons operating on a patient when that patient's body was open on the table and vulnerable to infection. So it kept the surgeon and the surgery team's germs to themselves. I'd even point you to a study early on that was used to say that masks are not effective and question its conclusions. So one early study was using a patient who had contracted coronavirus. It had them cough into a petri dish. Then it had them wear masks and cough into a petri dish again. Then they tested the inside and outside of the mask. Because they found a lot of the virus on the outside of the mask, they concluded that masks weren't effective. However, when you look at the petri dish of all of those, there was less viral load in the petri dishes. And to me, that indicates that masks are effective. It doesn't matter whether it's the inside of the mask that stops it or the outside of the mask, it stopped some of the virus. I'd look at a WHO study that examines 172 studies across 16 countries that show that wearing masks, eye protection, and physical distancing slows the spread of viruses. Another study of hospitality workers showed that those wearing masks versus those wearing face shields, the ones who wore masks were less likely to contract the virus. In fact, in all the research I've been looking over, I've only seen anecdotal evidence of where people believe that masks don't help. And all the studies that I've seen have been in support of masks. And then as a neurodiverse individual who's been like spending all my time on this research since March, I'd love to take you through what makes like a better and not better mask, but we're so limited on time. I'm going to tell you, we made a website and we will make that available to you. So I'm going to skip over that. If you want to ask me in the Q&A, you can. So I'm asking us to instead consider, what if we are convinced of the why and the how? Why aren't we as a widespread community making change? And to me, that's a psychological thing. So it is change behavior in psychology. So I'd like to preface this section with, these are my opinions born out of my research, my experience working with motivating teenagers and other things like that. They shouldn't represent my employer or the organizations I work for. But when we're as humans contemplating change, we think we tend to code things as right or wrong behaviors. And this helps us to prepare to make that change. Even if I'm doing a diet change, if I start thinking the eating this way is right versus the old way I've been eating is wrong, it helps me prepare to make that change. The problem with stopping at this point is that change is a lot more complicated than that. Anyone who's made a New Year's resolution and not stuck to it knows what I'm talking about. So when the behavior is left at an individual level and we've defined there as being a right, there inherently is a wrong. So if I believe that wearing a mask is right and I go into a store and you're not wearing a mask, it's my automatic judgment that you are doing something wrong. When you establish an expectation otherwise that norms the behavior, eventually it takes it out of personal ethical imperative. So in the same example, if I enter a store and see you wearing shoes, I really don't think much about it. Wearing shoes, though, does protect me and others, but it's just a normalized behavior. Indeed, if I'm in a store and see someone not wearing shoes, I think that they have a legitimate reason for not doing that, or that if not, someone with authority other than me will handle it. The second thing that a mask policy would do is it would provide extra incentive for an individual attempting change. So I hope at this point you know that I'm very passionate that we should wear masks, and I feel very strongly about it. Even I forget my mask. And if I go to work and arrive and I realize I've forgotten my mask, then I begin this series of mental compromises. I think I'm feeling healthy. It's just this many feet to my office. I've only been around my family for the past week. And so it might become easy for me to just go. But if you're like my employer and you have a mask directive out there, I will go back and get a mask, or I'll find where to find one. And that might be just inconvenient enough for me to like put measures in place. So I might stock my car with a week's worth of masks, or hide extra ones in my bag, or have them available for my students. So that's for me the biggest benefit of the local expectation to wear masks. It norms the behavior. In the absence of a stated expectation, we default to the easier behavior. It becomes an ethical and moral obligation and carries potential for judgment and shaming on both sides. I think our children are going to have enough going back to school that we don't have to make them in charge of policing one another. And anything leaders can do to encourage a behavior like this has the potential to protect community health. We should applaud it. I agree with statements like wearing a mask is patriotic, or I wear this mask for you.
Even once we know the importance of the masks, and once we know that this is something we really should do, I know the thing we keep hearing from Reynolds often touts is the context of our community. Masks should be good or not. Compounding on that topic, context is what we're hoping to help understand a bit more as Ms. Tucker Rainers, with her experience in public health and where we are right now as Iowa, why masks. This shouldn't be a question of, do you feel good? It is, this is the context that's here right now. Without that, Ms. Tucker Rainers.
Sure, thanks. As Chris said, my name is Lena Tucker Rainers. I'm the Executive Director of Iowa Public Health Association. Just a little bit of background on our organization. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan membership organization of public health professionals and students and retirees across Iowa. We have close to 450 members across Iowa, and our mission is to unite and strengthen the voice for public health in Iowa. Our concern with the current management of the pandemic here in Iowa is twofold. Number one, the lack of strong evidence-based public health mitigation strategies from state leaders. We're often told to do the right thing, but the perception of what is the right thing is not necessarily consistent with public health evidence. And then second, the preemption of local control. Absent a state mandate for masks, and you know, we just heard from Laura what the importance of masks are, local control is so important so that our local leaders, be they city officials, county supervisors, school superintendents, boards of health, can look at the evidence in their communities and make decisions that best protect their constituents. So by definition, coronavirus and COVID-19 are new phenomena, and we are learning as we go. And sometimes that's confused with waffling. So what that means, since we're learning as we go, is that the decisions that we made in March may not hold true today. And the decisions that we are making now may not hold true a few months from now. And that's because we're learning. We're learning because this is a new experience, something that we don't have, none of us have lived through in the past. There's experiences that we can draw on, and there's expertise that we can draw on to make educated decisions at the moment. But as we learn more, as the virus evolves, as we see how community spread goes, we can base our decisions accordingly. For example, just yesterday, the World Health Organization made a statement about how the coronavirus is not following what the expected seasonal patterns of influenza are. And so that's how we decide, we make decisions based upon what we learned. It was not possible for us to have known that back in March. But now that we've been through several seasons, we can see how the virus is behaving. So again, what's important is that our leaders and decision makers respect that learning is occurring and be willing to adapt their positions with current evidence and not be beholden to political agendas. Public health is not political. It should never be political. Unfortunately, however, we see the end result is that it sometimes is politicized. But the guidelines are a 14-day quarantine. And so to have kids and faculty and teachers return to class 24 hours fever-free is concerning. COVID-19 will not magically appear in a classroom. We know that it will be brought in through community spread. And what that means is that community mitigation strategies are essential for the success of any in-person return to learn plans. As Laura mentioned, widespread use of masks and social distancing are critical strategies to control the spread of coronavirus. I want to emphasize, too, that one of the things that we often hear is like, oh, it's only a 1%, 2%, whatever percent, tiny percent death rate. Well, this disease is more than death. There's so much disability. We use the word morbidity that comes along with this disease. And so we don't want to talk only about deaths, which are horrific, deaths that shouldn't be occurring. But we know that the long-term effects, we're just starting to learn now what those are. And so preventing the spread of COVID is not just about preventing deaths. It's about preventing sickness and illness that will have potentially long-lasting effects. Back to masks, mounting evidence supports the use of masks, including research conducted right here at the University of Iowa. And that research showed that states that have implemented mask mandates have seen reduced transmission of coronavirus in as little as 5 days from the issuance of the mandate. And the more days that proceed following the mandate, the more reduced transmission occurs. And so what that tells us is that masks work. And I really like what Laura was saying about the modeling, because we hear a lot about like, well, how are you going to enforce that? It's like, well, how do we enforce any laws? By role modeling, by becoming a community norm, and by really going after the people who are gross offenders. Of issues. So we're not, you know, there's not going to be mask police on every corner, you know, ticketing you if you haven't worn a mask. But I mean, what this does is it helps to establish that community norm. And so people who maybe want to wear a mask, but are a little nervous about wearing a mask, they don't want to answer to the questions from family or friends that are maybe anti-mask, this kind of gives cover and allows everybody to move forward with masking being the norm. And so this is why IPHA issued a statement calling for a mask mandate on July 23rd. The following week, Iowa Medical Society sent a letter to the governor. And since then, there's been various press conferences and more calls for mask mandates, including from local public health directors across the state. Despite all these calls from experts, it does not seem that a statewide mask mandate will be issued anytime soon. And this is why it's so important to have local control. Again, so that cities, counties, school districts can follow the evidence and do what's best for their communities. And we will continue to support that and advocate for that and be of assistance to groups when they feel our assistance can be helpful.
I always think it's interesting speaking with, you know, individuals who believe in science, believe in facts, because it's remarkably high and concerning become the understatements of the day, which is always interesting. And I think it's also interesting we're worried about local control because we have an absence of fact-based statewide leadership. If we had that, we should still be able to do the right stuff at the local level. However, when we say, why can't we enforce a mask mandate in school? If a kid showed up with no pants, he'd probably get sent home to get some. This isn't difficult. This happens every single day. I don't see kids without pants on in our children's school. We could probably also make sure that they have a mask. So with these pieces of, we know masks are a big thing. We know that functional leadership towards these policies is vital. When we're looking at the bigger context and looking at now medically, we're talking about those issues of, we don't know what's happening yet. We're excited to have from Fort Dodge, Dr. Shreninas, help us understand what is the latest that we do know with the disease itself, with potential implications of it itself. Why are these things like masks, smart public health guidance, smart reasonableness in how we actually approach infection rates? What is it about this disease right now that we know the best? And what do we need to know more of before we can be comfortable?
Thank you so much for having me, Chris, and to the organization. This is a great conversation. I'm really excited to have this group of people together to talk about the facts. My name is Megan Srinivas, as Chris said. I'm an infectious disease physician and a public health researcher. And there are so many things to really unpack that we still have yet to learn about when it comes to COVID. As Lena mentioned before, it's a constantly evolving disease. We're constantly learning more. This has only been around for really 6 to 7 months. So it's a really new disease, and getting the full grasp of it is going to take time. That being said, when we don't have data, we can't make assumptions just because we want them to be true. And that's unfortunately what we're seeing a lot of policymakers doing. They're making incorrect assumptions, assumptions that could be very dangerous. And so I want to dispel some of these myths, especially based on the medical science that we do know. One of the things that we have heard a lot of leaders at the national state level say over and over again is that children can't get this disease, that children can't be infected, and that they can't be carriers or transmit it to others. This is blatantly untrue. We didn't have early data when people started making these assumptions, but we did have supporting cases that said it was untrue. And now, starting in July, we've started to have abundance of data coming out showing us that, in fact, children do transmit this disease. They do carry it. The American Academy of Pediatrics, along with the Children's Hospital Association, just published their own report on COVID in children. And during the last 2 weeks of July alone, just 2 weeks prior to schools even opening, they found that 97,000 children had been infected in the United States. That's a 40% increase in children's infections during a 2 week period prior to schools even being open, prior to children really coming in contact with one another in these closed, confined spaces. On top of that, there was a case study that was done in Georgia where they had a 1 week sleepaway camp. And they looked to see what the infection rate, or what they called the attack rate, meaning how many people were infected during that 1 week of camp. They found that of the 597 people that were there, 260 ended up getting infected. And it wasn't just amongst the counselors. In fact, the highest infection rate was amongst the youngest campers, those between the ages of 6 and 10. 51% of those ended up being infected by the end of camp. On top of that, when we look at JAMA, they did a modeling study in which they saw what the impact of school closures actually had been, the statewide school closures that we did back in March, what that impact was on the transmission of COVID throughout the country. And they found that by doing early closures before we had large, widespread community prevalence, that the transmission that would have happened through children actually saved and reduced caseload within the United States by 61%. And it had an estimated reduction in mortality of 58%. That is a significant chunk. When we're looking at already having more than 160,000 deaths in this country, reducing that mortality rate by 58% is significant. And that shows that we do attribute quite a bit of transmission to children's ability to not just get the infection, but then carry it home with them and transmit to their parents, their siblings, their caretakers, whoever they interact with in the community. On top of that, a recent study actually wanted to see what the actual amount of shedding, which means how much virus are children able to give, to share with each other? How contagious are they? And they did it in blocks. They looked to see between 5 and 10 years old, all the way up through adult. And they found that it was that young subset of children, those between 5 and 10, that actually had the highest rate of shedding, meaning the most virus that they were able to transmit, even more so than adults, which raises the question, have we just been overlooking the fact that children can carry this and perhaps even transmit it and be more contagious than adults? And so it's very concerning that we're just blindly launching into reopening schools in person without any kind of thought process to what type of mitigation strategies we're going to have both within the school as well as within the community to reduce the community prevalence to ensure that safe return to school is possible. Another question that often comes up with this is antibodies and immunity. A lot of decisions are being made based on the fact that people assume that once you get the infection, you can't get it again. This is not an assumption we can make yet. In fact, if we look at the larger family of coronaviruses, COVID-19 is just one virus within this larger family. So the other cousins of COVID-19, which are within this larger family, they typically can cause an infection after infection after infection. We usually say that about 60 days after your initial infection, you're completely able to get reinfected again. And we see it. I, for one, have gotten the common cold more than once, as many people have. That's because the common cold is a cousin of COVID-19. It's another type of coronavirus. So based on the science, we wouldn't expect COVID-19 to act too differently. And the data that's starting to emerge now is showing us that actually, when we look at people who've had COVID-19 and we look at their blood, 60 days out from their initial infection, we no longer are seeing those antibodies in their blood. And that's for the majority of cases, the mild cases, or what we call mild cases, which are the 80% of people who aren't hospitalized. So when we're already seeing the data saying, hey, we're not seeing antibodies, and we don't even know if these antibodies do confer protection against reinfection if they exist, and we have a backlog of science that shows us other coronaviruses are able to get reinfected over and over again, it's a misassumption to say that you cannot get reinfected, that we can establish herd immunity just by natural infection. And it's not a game that we should be playing with our community members' lives. Another issue that has often come up is this whole concept of recovery. What does recovery actually mean? The problem is, we don't know yet. It's a disease that's only been around for 6 to 7 months, and we have no idea what the long-term consequences are. We are seeing people, unfortunately, having quite long-term damage to their lungs, having potentially permanent damage to their kidneys, their hearts, their livers. This isn't a disease that we can say, hey, once you've got it, you're over it and you're recovered just because you're at that magic 28-day mark. And we don't want to play this game by having our children go back to school, by having them being able to spread this virus to one another, by carrying it home, by endangering the community as a whole.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts for today, Gina McAndrews and Susan Franson. Other voices you heard were Leanne Harter, Chad Hart, Chris Draper, Lena Tucker-Reiners, Megan Schrenivas, and Laura Vardhausen.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon, the Ames Public Library will present Reading Radio. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org.
Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballads of Kate Shelley.
If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. Remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.